This week, we celebrate Veterans Day with some classic interviews with great American heroes. Korean War veteran and commander of the first major U.S. engagement in Vietnam, Lieutenant General Hal Moore. And later, Vietnam prisoner of war and former U.S. senator from Alabama, Admiral Jeremiah Denton, talks about the 8 years he spent in the Hanoi Hilton and the faith that sustained him. Finally, Academy Award-nominated actor, director, and philanthropist Gary Sinise talks about his work on behalf of our nation's fighting men and women. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo, and you can also find me on Instagram at Real Raymond Arroyo. A Korean War veteran and commander of the first U.S. engagement in the Vietnam War, Lieutenant General Hal Moore was a true leader, respected by his men and his enemies. He was a West Point graduate, an author, a beloved husband and father. Mel Gibson immortalized him on the big screen in We Were Soldiers, which was based on General Moore's memoirs. Hal Moore passed away in 2017. He was 94. I sat down with him in 2008, and we talked about the Catholic faith, so important to him in the military and in life.
Let's talk for a moment about one of the battles that defined your life, the Yadrang battle. Tell me what that was like and what lingering marks it has left on you 40-plus years later.
This battle occurred in November of 1965. I was a lieutenant colonel in infantry commanding 450 men of the 11th of the 1st Cavalry Division, Air Mobile. And we were ordered into the Yadrang Valley of South Vietnam, next to the Cambodian border, to find and kill a suspected large enemy force. The enemy was indeed there, and we wound up fighting for 3 days and nights nonstop against probably over 2,000 North Vietnamese regulars, well-armed, automatic weapons, and they were not afraid to die. I lost 79 of my precious men killed and 120 wounded, and none missing in action. One of my proudest accomplishments in two wars in Asia is that I have never lost a man prisoner of war or missing in action. I brought them all home.
And that was a vow you made to those men. You vowed to them that you'd bring every one of them back, and you made them promise that they'd bring you back if you fell on that battlefield.
That's exactly right.
And you made good on that promise.
Yes, that promise was made at a formation at Fort Benning, Georgia, before we went to Vietnam. And I promised my men I'd bring them all home. And I said, if I go down, I want you to bring me home, too.
Let's talk for a moment about those men. I know they mean a lot to you. You get together with them, what is it, every Veterans Day?
Well, we get together over Veterans Day, and also on occasion we have reunions during the year. My men in 1965 were a mixture of regular Army volunteers and draftees. Wow. So, in fact, probably over maybe three-fourths of my troopers were draftees. But they fought hard, they fought well for each other, and they were not afraid to die. I was born in a Catholic family in a small town in Kentucky. I was raised by Catholic teachers through the eighth grade by the nuns of St. Francis Xavier, by the Sisters of Charity. And then I went to St. Joseph Prep School, run by the Brothers of St. Francis Xavier. I went to Mass almost every day. And then when I went to West Point, I was so dumb at West Point that the only reason that I got through West Point was going to Mass almost daily and praying to God to help me get through West Point. But I'm proud to say that I graduated at the top of the bottom 20% of my class.
All right, that a boy. You were right there with me. We were in the same class. You had a Father Murdoch who was your spiritual director and kind of mentor at West Point. What influence did he have on you?
My first week at West Point, I think I got there on a Wednesday. We reported in, and we were treated very sternly by the upperclassmen, I'll put it mildly. But on Saturday, after the inspection at noon, and at 1 o'clock Saturday inspection in ranks, we were formed as a group, and we were told that each of you now have an opportunity to go to a church of your choice. And we had a non-denominational chaplain, and we had a Catholic chaplain. And I chose to go to the Catholic chaplain. I was born and raised a Catholic. And I met Father Murdoch at that time. And I became very close friends with Father Murdoch all through my years at West Point. I was very dumb in mathematics, which was is based on West Point was based on mathematics in those days. And I had to study late at night till 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And I went to Mass every morning at 6:30, and that's when you had to fast the night before. You couldn't eat before communion. But I went to Mass every morning at 7 o'clock, 20-minute Mass by Father Murdoch, and that got me through West Point. And all through my life, I have tried to keep fresh in my mind that the whole purpose of life on earth is to qualify for life hereafter in heaven with our Father in heaven. And I've tried to do that in my life. And this booklet here, A General Spiritual Journey, documents my firm religious beliefs. I'm a Catholic. I was raised a Catholic, but my mother was a non-Catholic. She raised us all Catholic. My father was a Catholic. And I really, it doesn't matter to me what religion that a person has, if he's Jewish, if he's Protestant, Methodist, Baptist. Mm-hmm. We all come from the same God, and we all must worship the same God. And someday we will all meet that same God, and He'll pronounce judgment on us. And I'm going to do my best to qualify to make the cut.
You and me both. Listen, did you always want to be a soldier?
Probably so. I was a Boy Scout. I loved being in uniform as a Boy Scout. I read every book I could find in the school library on West Point, and I developed at an early age a firm ambition and desire to go to West Point and be an Army officer. I tried hard to get an appointment through my regular senators and congressmen, but I was unable to do that. And finally, at the age of 17, I was offered a job in Washington, D.C., in the Senate warehouse, and I immediately left St. Joe Prep. I finished high school at night with taxi cab drivers and government workers in Washington.
All alone?
I lived with an elderly couple, and then I finished high school at night. Then I went to George Washington University at night for 2.5 years. Wow. I joined a fraternity, Kappa Sigma fraternity, lived in the house, and every 2 weeks, I would get the list from the Army on which senators and congressmen had not yet appointed a board of West Point. And I knocked on those doors. Now, without success for 2 years, 2.5 years now. Wow. Now I'm talking about I was from 17 to 18 to 19 to 20 years old. And then when the war began after Pearl Harbor, in the spring of 1941, 42, the Congress authorized every senator and congressman to have one additional appointment to West Point and to Annapolis.
And you made the cut.
And at that time, I went to my congressman, and he said, "I'm sorry, but I've already given that to another son or to another boy." And I said, "Well, can I have your appointment to Annapolis, to the Naval Academy?" And he said, "Yes, I'll give that to you." Then I said, sir, if I can find another congressman to swap and appoint me to West Point, would you appoint his kid to Annapolis? And he said, I hadn't heard of that. But if you can pull it off, I'll do it.
You're like Monty Hall. You're making deals all over the place. I love this.
It took me 10 days, and I found a congressman from Georgia who would appoint me to West Point. And I was appointed to West Point from the 2nd District of Georgia, Thomasville, Thomas County, Georgia.
I love it. And you've never been there.
I've never been to Georgia in my life.
You know, I remember talking to Mel Gibson several years ago, and he mentioned that the first time he met you, you were praying, he heard you praying a prayer. And when he heard it, he completed the prayer along with you. And it was a prayer from Pope Clement the 11th. And I'll read this prayer. It says, discover to me, O my God, the nothingness of this world, the greatness of heaven, the shortness of time, and the length of eternity. And you say in this book, someone's asked you, what business are you in? And you say what?
I tell them all, I'm in the business of eternity. And that's the business that I am in. And I hope I'm successful in that business personally.
I want to share with people before we run out of time. You recently wrote an open letter. This was an Independence Day letter to America. And it was called A Pledge of Sacred Honor. Yes. And in it, you write, the national door of principled leadership is wide open for sacred honor, civility, and a sense of kinship and trust. And you're really urging all Americans, but particularly these presidential contenders, to be aware and sign a promise of civility. Why is that so important to you?
Whether or not they sign a paper advocating civility is irrelevant. It would be helpful if they did. But I'm convinced that any person, man or woman, running for public office should be civil towards their opposite numbers who are trying to beat them. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important. Civility is not only important in the political arena, but in day-to-day activities in all professions. Men and women should be respected and treated civilly, mm-hmm. with respect.
Well, sir, I just want to say personally, you have not only spoken words that are inspiring and lead us, I think, in the right direction, but you've demonstrated them throughout your life. Happy Independence Day, and I thank you for being here again.
God bless General Hal Moore. Admiral Jeremiah Denton was shot down by the North Vietnamese in 1965. He spent 8 years in the notorious Hanoi Hilton prison. And the way he orchestrated his escape is rather interesting. It was part of a propaganda broadcast of 1966. I spoke with Admiral Denton about the bravery and heroism and sacrifice that he endured while in the Hanoi Hilton and subsequently. He wrote a book called When Hell Was in Session. Here's my interview with Admiral Jeremiah Denton.
Admiral, to begin, 1965, I want to take you back to Vietnam. You're shot down, you land in a river, and they begin fishing you out. What is going through your mind at that moment?
Anger, frustration. But before we start, I have to say, all this hero stuff, the only hero of my story is Jesus Christ, not me, okay?
Okay. Well, we will definitely get to that as well.
Yeah.
When you're in there, when they're fishing you out, you're angry, and then they take you and they confine you. They begin to imprison you. What was that like?
Well, from there, they took me blindfolded back to Hanoi, put me in a prison. And what was it like? It's a disorientation. You first start fearing you're going to lose track of time, and you mm-hmm. start making calendars on the wall like the mythical prisoners do. Yeah. And then you learn that Sunday's come and it's quiet and you're able to keep track of time. And you're very conscious that you better know the day because you're going to be accountable later when you get home for what happened. And suddenly time and events per time mean a tremendous amount. That's one of the first impressions. Then when you settle down and realize what your condition is, the next thing that comes in is fear. They're going to torture you for military information or right. for propaganda stuff. When I was shot down, they weren't torturing, but we were scared they were. They would put a gun to your head and say, tell us so-and-so where we're going to shoot. And I'd say, well, shoot, and it'd click. And it, but we thought that they might start doing it for real, which they did in October of that year. And then it was quite a ride from then on.
What were they after? I know they wanted biographies, confessions. What were those designed for?
Right. The search for military information was not conventional as in wartime. For the Japanese and Germans in certain situations it may have been, but for us, they knew we didn't know anything. The plans were being, when I was shot down, were being made in the White House virtually. Right. And nobody knew. No general or admiral knew what was going to happen the next day. So why? That's one thing they'd like to know. So, and the weaponry, it didn't matter much to them. They couldn't do anything about what we had, so they weren't after that. Their strategy and their determination was to bend us to be used, break us to be used for propaganda, because their whole strategy of the war was to go through a few little military dilatory diversions and win the war back in Washington, New York, and Chicago, and in college campuses. And so we were to be broken and to advocate their side in the war. That was their principal objective. In that, they, I think, lost that war. They managed to get a few guys to do that, but most of us didn't give them anything credible in that, in that respect.
You all used to come up with fictitious biographies and that sort of thing to pacify them and to get out.
We'd make them torturous for that. And to say to unconsciousness, you know, you can't be tortured any further than that. Or pull a guy's arms out of socket and then he'd give him a biography and it would be absurd. I had a particularly flamboyant one I would like to see printed on New York Times, and I made them torture me every time they got it. But it was like that.
What sort of torture were they doing
almost
in the beginning?
Almost different. Well, mostly the rope tricks by which they would bind you up in ropes, cut off the blood circulation, which sounds nothing, but pretty soon your heart's pounding so hard, trying to send blood through your body that you can hear it pounding, and you pass out after. And then they maybe the first time that happens to you, you break and give them a biography or something. But after you can take it and pass out, maybe fast a little bit and get real weak, that doesn't work too well. It was hard for them. But men are subject to different levels of pain that they can take, you know.
And you were very resolute that you weren't going to give them certainly any military secrets, and you even stashed a little piece of glass in your cell. Why did you do that?
Yeah, I'm a little discomfited. I think they've said something in the code about you resist until the point of no return. But there's a weak part in there. I still think I wasn't able to go to that debriefing. I was asked, but I couldn't. I was doing something else. But I don't think that we should forget that if you give classified military information, particularly sensitive, that you know about, such as ECM, where you turn it, when you turn it on, how you turn it on, you can cost the lives of other men, many men. So you got to think about whether you ever should do that. Shouldn't that be an absolute rule, that to the point of ultimate will or resistance, you don't give classified military information. I intended not to, and I had broken glass in my cell and in case they started. They give you plenty of days to make up your mind. They threaten you before. If they gotten on that tack, I would have cut my wrists.
Tell me about there was a rig they instituted in your cell for 5 days.
There were so
days.
Many rigs. It's kind of complicated. The one you're talking about is when I surrendered to God.
Yeah.
It was. It's kind of hard to describe. I was down to about 120 pounds at that point. I didn't have any meat on my butt, so I was sitting on this concrete bed with my ankles in stocks and my hands handcuffed behind me in what they called hell cuffs, which is very painful. A gag in my mouth and blindfolded, and they had a rig. Under my ankles, under my Achilles tendons, was a bar which they could pull on from above on a pulley and push it into my Achilles tendons, and it couldn't go anywhere because my legs are in irons on the top.
Right.
And
so it would just eat away at the Achilles tendon eventually.
Right. They got almost halfway through mine. The first, I surrendered after 5 days and nights thinking that they would accept some bland lie, some truths they already knew. They wanted to know what our camp communications was. I was a camp commander. If we had lost those communications, they were very complex, countermeasure type thing we've been working on for a long time. We were heavily relying on it for morale and order and discipline.
Right.
The chain of command. I wasn't about to give it. But I said, bow cow, I surrendered. They took me in, and I wrote a bunch of stuff they already knew. And I thought, well, they're going to let me go because they don't want me to die. That was the key. Mm-hmm. You had to convince them that your life, they had to take your life. They didn't want to kill us. They wanted to save us and exploit us.
Mm-hmm.
So to my surprise and dismay, they put me back in the rig. And it got pretty hopeless. I couldn't think. I couldn't pray and anymore. And I said to God, it's not easy to say, expressed with my whole being, I can't think of anything else to pray. I can't think of any recited prayers. I can't think of any spontaneous prayers. I'm in a desperate situation. If anything happens good out of this, it's going to be yours. You got it. You got me. You got everything about me. The instant I said that, I had been going through alternating periods of feeling heat and feeling chills. I was shaking at that time, and you could hear my chains around the camp. And the instant I willed that, it was like a blanket of warmth, just a whole aura of composure, of no pain. The pain was immediate release, which was in my back. That was the principal part of the pain. And I just went from fear, anxiety, almost an unendurable pain, to complete comfort and assurance and no fear. A few minutes later, the guard came in, the camp commander. This is the only time I know that this happened. The camp commander himself came, a guy we call the Lump. He was a pretty senior guide. He came with the two guards and told him to go in there and break Denton. Break his legs if you have to, but break him. And he was screaming. He was screaming at them. They came in, and one of the boys was about 19 years old, pretty good kid. We called him Smiley. He did his duty. He tortured, but I don't think he liked it. At any rate, he and the other guard started pulling on his pulley. And I just looked at Smiley with a smile, expressing what was in me. I don't hurt. You're not going to break me, and you're not a bad guy. How can you do this to another human being? His face broke, contorted, tears. He yanked the other guard off the pulley and went outside and started screaming at the camp commander. He wasn't going to do that anymore. They're going to have to find somebody else. And 20 minutes later, they came in and put sulfa on my open wounds, released the rig, and carried me out to an isolated place where I supposedly couldn't tell the other guys I hadn't given in.
Your faith and your honor.
That was a miracle to me.
Yeah. Your faith and your honor really fused in that experience, in all your experience in this time.
I don't know why you're throwing honor in there, but faith, yes. Faith, that was the most terrific product of a prayer, of an answer to a prayer that I ever gotten. But all the way through prison, it was like that. They say, you know, anybody in pain or suffering is going to pray. No atheists in foxholes. Some woman with a difficult delivery. They're going to pray, and they're going to get relief of some kind. God's going to help them in some way. Right. And we had so many examples of that because we were under such constant pressure and pain and suffering and fear that we prayed a lot, and we got a lot of answers. And there's nothing new about that. It's throughout the history of the world and in most everybody's lives. So I don't like to be, you know, praised for receiving grace from God. You always do.
But you cooperated with it, and you understood it when it was going on, and some people don't. They waste that suffering. They waste that pain.
I don't know about that. But, I think most people cooperate when they're in pain and they're getting help.
Admiral, at this point, tell me what freedom means to you after this experience, and faith, and how they're really bound in your mind.
Well, before the experience, intensely during the experience, and intensely after the experience, I've devoted a lot of thought to the relationship between faith and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to Athens, the first time democracy was really tried, and darn near the last, because the next time it was Switzerland, and they didn't really complete their democracy the way we did. But in Athens, it failed. It became a classic example, which indicated to the political world, the political science world, that democracy won't work. Sooner or later, the people just can't handle it. They get to the point where demagogues, which is a word that came in then, mm-hmm. can, knowing that they all have special interests, can demagogically talk to them, get them in groups, mess up the unity of the country,
right.
Promise them things that they can't afford for the state to give. And in other words, they lack self-discipline and compassion. They're trying to be, they're just greedy. That's us. We're greedy. But if you have the self-discipline and compassion, let's say it's morality, our founding fathers realized that if you have sufficient self-discipline and compassion, they knew that morality was necessary. And I'd like to read a quote from George Washington because it's so darn important. It takes about, this is what our government ought to read now. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morals are indispensable supports. Let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar stature, both reason and experience forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. When I came home, after all the meditation on things like that, realizing that compassion and self-discipline are indispensable to a democracy, and that the only source of that kind of morality comes from religion, where your life, your eternal life, depends on whether you love your neighbor as you love yourself, which is just compassion. We've thrown that out now, subtly, by a period of judicial and legislative, following the judicial rulings, based on nothing, that you can't have the Ten Commandments in a school, because the kids might look at the Ten Commandments and start thinking about them. Well, the country was built on that. Our founding fathers recognized that God, this nation was based on God. And William Penn said it as well as any, men must choose to be governed by God or condemn themselves to be ruled by tyrants. Why? What happened to those statements which founded this country? We soft people, enjoying the consumption of what the previous good principles have produced in a way of a system blessed by God, and we respecting him. Think of the founding fathers. They came over from a nation where they'd been persecuted from before. They crossed a hazardous ocean. They landed on a hostile shore with Indians in the climate. They, like POWs or any other soldiers, suffered. They knew about the reality of God, and they were able to be formed into a nation which was knowingly dependent upon God. There were numerous references to God. And in addition, the system was, it was a greater revolution than that. It said, all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Never before. It was God, king, divine right of kings, then the people. God, the revolution says, man, individual man, then government, the servant of the people. And they invented a system to do that. And it worked beautifully for a long time. And starting in about after 1950, the premise was questioned. And now, instead of being one nation under God, we are conscientiously and formally and officially one nation without God. And we're wondering why we're having problems. We haven't seen any problems yet unless this reverses.
I want to talk about how you, as an outgrowth of your faith and this conviction and this understanding of freedom, when given the opportunity to go before the cameras and during your interrogation as a POW, you did something extraordinary. And I have tape of that. I want you to look at this and tell me what you're doing here. This is during an interrogation, a television interview.
Well, 3 days ago, they hit me for confession. I'd been tortured unconscious a number of times. I gave them what I hope was a not credible confession. Then they told me, set me up on the top of two stools placed on top of each other and told me they were going to do this to me, have me interviewed, and I was to condemn my government.
Right.
But
the blinking thing.
Reisner and I prayed about what I should do. Should I just refuse to go to the interview or go? and try to blow it up. And the chances of that working were 1,000,000 to 1, because I go there and I defy them, and then they burn the tape and torture me some more. But I decided to try that, okay? And I got there, and they entered the room, and as they came in, there were these lights like that, and I said, in case they change the words that I intend to say, I'm going to blink the word torture to prove that they at least had to torture me to get me here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when he asked me the questions, they asked me twice, the key sentence being, what do you think of the policy of your government in Vietnam? The first time I said, I don't know what the policy of my government is, because the only sources of news I have are North Vietnamese. But whatever the policy of my government is, I support it, and I will support it as long as I live. Mm-hmm. They asked me another time, and I said, I don't know what the policy is now, but whatever. But I am a member of that government, mm-hmm. and it is my job to support it, and I will support it as long as I live. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought when they dragged me out of there that nobody was ever going to see that, and I was going to get hurt pretty bad. Mm-hmm. I was hurt pretty bad, the worst torture I ever got after that. But by the grace of God, that Japanese photographer who had been having such interviews and taping tortured confessions knew he had a big scoop. Mm-hmm. He sneaked out of Hanoi that night, went back to Tokyo and auctioned it off. The first bidder was ABC for $50,000. Mm-hmm. And I didn't learn until 3 days before I was released that when Red McDaniel, who was in that movie you just showed, he was one of the two shown, mm-hmm. Told me that he had seen it. I didn't know how much they'd seen it. I got right. home, I didn't know how that a lot of people had seen it.
Right, and Navy
and
intelligence
I was so
read
grateful
torture.
To God, that was the most great. Yeah, they read the torture, but I believe they knew guys were already being tortured by the mm-hmm. fact that some were confession. I was not proud of that. I was proud that I defied them. That's what, when the Navy gave me the tape of that, they said Denton not only blinked the word torture, he defied the North Vietnamese. Mm. I'm glad God gave me the grace to do that.
Now, once you and your fellow POWs were liberated, you were chosen to speak on their behalf. Here's what you
had to
say.
No, I wasn't chosen. I was a senior officer on the first plane to land. That's why I
okay.
spoke.
Well, here's what you had to say.
I was chosen to take the rest of them home after that to Hawaii and the West Coast.
Right. Here's what you had to say on February 12, 1972, when you arrived at Clark Air Force Base.
1973. I got that wrong in the tape. It's 1973.
Honored. Okay. We've had the opportunity to serve our country under difficult circumstances. We are profoundly grateful to our Commander-in-Chief and to our nation for this day. God bless America. God bless America.
Admiral Denton, what should people know? What should they take from this experience you went through?
Well, again, let's go to veterans. Lexington and Concord, the Battle of New Orleans, Chateau Thierry, D-Day, mm-hmm. Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Kosovo. They're talking about veterans' absentee ballots coming into Florida now. Mm-hmm. They burned them. It was another story, but they have disposed of those before. I hope to God somebody is watching over those, because those men deserve to have their votes counted. Mm-hmm. And this has been circulated on the Internet vis-a-vis this election and these guys who voted. Remember, it is the soldier and the sailor, not the reporter, who has given us freedom of the press. It is the soldier and the sailor, not the poet, who has given us freedom of speech. It is the soldier and the sailor, not the campus organizer, who has given us the freedom to demonstrate. It is the soldier and the sailor who salutes the flag, who serves beneath the flag, whose coffin is draped by the flag, who allows a protester to burn the flag.
What is the message you would give people? What should they remember as a result of this interview and your experience?
Semper Fidelis, always faithful.
And finally, he was nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal of Lieutenant Dan in the 1994 blockbuster Forrest Gump. And it really set him on an entire new path for his life. He became the founder of his own foundation, the Gary Sinise Foundation, which works on behalf of our nation's fighting men and women. I sat down with Gary at his offices, and we talked about his career, what inspired him to take up this, his concerns and the concerns of veterans, and the work that really has become the focus of his life. Here's my interview with Gary Sinise.
Gary, I want to start with your acting career because there's a nice tie-in. Really, the theater and film gave way to this, what's become your life's work. Tell me a little bit about how you stumbled into the theater in high school.
Well, I was playing in a band, in a rock band in high school, and I was standing in this hallway with the members of my band, and we looked pretty scruffy, I think, and the drama teacher, this little lady, this powerhouse kind of tornado of a lady, walked down the hallway. She turned around, she said, "Come and audition for West Side Story. You look perfect for the gang members." And then she pedaled off, and I had just seen the movie of West Side Story or something, or actually I was in a different high school when I was a freshman than a sophomore, and at the other high school they had done West Side Story. That's what it was.
Oh, so you were
familiar
with it.
And then I moved, and it's my sophomore year, and now my new high school is going to do that play.
Mm. Then right after high school, you and two of your friends find what's become now an institution, Steppenwolf Theater Company. And you found it, you started in a church basement.
Yes. So I did my first play as a sophomore. It was West Side Story, and I met Jeff Perry, he played Tony in the show. And we became fast friends. We did a lot of plays in high school together. And after I graduated, I, with some of the kids, started this theater. And Jeff was at college, and he met this buddy, and they became fast friends, Terry Kinney, and we were doing this theater up in Highland Park, Illinois, and they were down in the central Illinois at Illinois State, and I said, "Come up for the summer and do a play with us." So they came up, the three of us bonded, and we said we were going to make a go at starting a real company when they got out of college, which we did, and that became Steppenwolf Theater back in the origins were 1974, and then we started that group in 1976. And ironically, I was looking for a space in Highland Park, Illinois, that we could do this in, and there was a Catholic school that had closed down.
Huh.
The parish was there, but the school had closed. And there was a basement of this place that the youth commissioner in this town knew about because they had used it for like a teen center.
Mm-hmm.
He took me there. I saw the space. I thought we could put a theater in there. I went to the priest and said, "Would you let us have this?" These kids? I was 18 years old or something.
And
you let us have the basement so that we could do plays in there? And he said, "Sure."
Oh, my God. And that's really where this institution now, I mean, look, you've gone to Broadway and the West End and films and, I mean...
Our first permanent theater was in the basement of a closed-down Catholic school.
Mm. Yeah. It was a harbinger of things to come, Gary.
How about that?
then you play, of course, Lieutenant Dan Taylor in Forrest Gump years later. I'm fast-forwarding. That role, it not only marked you in the minds of so many people because that was such a beloved role, but it also opened up a whole new world for you in the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, I have veterans in my family, and on my wife's side of the family, three Vietnam veterans, her two brothers and her sister's husband. Hmm. So back in the 70s and early 80s, I got this education from the Vietnam veterans and my family about what it was like to be a Vietnam veteran coming home from war and how difficult that was for them to not only fight in Vietnam, but to come home to this nation that was divided and turning its back on them.
Mm-hmm.
So I got involved with Vietnam veterans back in the 80s, just trying to support them in the Chicago area. And then I moved out to California and was trying to get in the movie business. And I started auditioning for some things. And I did a couple of movies. And then along came the audition for Forrest Gump to play a Vietnam veteran. So having spent the time with the Vietnam veterans and my family and others in Chicago trying to help them, I very much wanted to play that part. And I went in and auditioned for it, and I got it. And that was very, very fortunate because it changed a lot of things, not only my acting career, but it gave me an insight into our wounded that I hadn't had prior to that, and that I've lived with ever since.
Well, I know a lot of the veterans, they saw you in that role and so identified with you. Did that open? Was that really the catalyst that opened so many doors? I mean, because when Gary Sinise walked into Walter Reed or walked into a combat situation, it was Lieutenant Dan that walked in with him. Their minds.
Well, you know, that was a time where my face was more well known than my name. Because the movie was so
huge,
It was huge. Everybody saw it.
Yeah, you were nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah, but not a lot of people knew who the guy was that played Lieutenant Dan. They just saw Lieutenant Dan. And when I started going on USO tours and all of that, they started calling me that all the time. And I'd go into the hospitals and go into these rooms with double amputees, and they'd want me to talk about that character.
And then on 9/11, in the wake of 9/11, you tell the story of being at a church, and you felt a calling. Tell me about that.
It was actually 3 days after September 11th. September 11th was on a Tuesday. And that Friday, George Bush, the president, called for a National Day of Prayer to happen on the Friday after September 11th.
Right.
So churches all over the country were just packed. They were filled.
People.
Everyone was going to their churches just trying to find some healing, something to help, you know, deal with our broken heart. And I went to our local Catholic church. And, you know, our kids had been going to the school there. And and I remember standing room only. I was standing up on the side, and they were singing God Bless America, and everybody had tears. And, I mean, it was very powerful, very moving. And our priest was moving in his homily that day, talking about service and how service above self was very healing, and that we all needed to try to do something to help our country heal. And I heard that very specifically that Friday after September 11th, and that, I think, galvanized something in me, and I just felt called by God to do something to help heal the men and women, you know, who were deploying in response to that event. Once we started deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we started losing people, they started getting hurt, I thought, that's where I can place my energy. That's where I can I can serve. I've been involved with Vietnam veterans. I don't want our active duty folks deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan to come home to a nation that treated them the way our Vietnam veterans were treated. So what can I do to help? I can go out there and pat them on the back and visit them and do things. And I started doing everything I could to just pitch in. And it all manifested itself into the creation of this foundation that I have now.
Tell me about this RISE initiative that you have created.
We have five surviving quadruple amputees, service members who've lost both arms and both legs. The first one survived a bombing in April of 2009. And I had a trip to go to Walter Reed to visit folks. My buddy who was over there called me up and said, we've got a quadruple amputee here. He's the first one to survive that injury. He's going to be at Walter Reed. When you get there, go see him.
Wow.
So I did. And about a year later, I did a concert to raise money to build him a home. And in the meantime, we had several others come in with the same injury, losing both arms and both legs. So we ended up doing concerts to try to raise money to help build these houses.
And these are not just your run-of-the-mill house. These are houses that are really tricked out and accommodate their injuries.
Once I started my foundation in 2011, we created a program to help build these homes, and that's our RISE program, Restoring Independence supporting empowerment. We want to, they've had a lot of their independence taken away because they can't do things for themselves.
Right.
And when they're living in a house that isn't specifically designed to their needs, there are a lot of problems. They can't reach up to the cupboard
right.
or whatever it is.
Yeah, they can't get upstairs if they
have
to.
We put all kinds of stuff in these houses to allow them to take care of themselves so that their caregiver, if it's their wife or their mom or dad or whoever it is, can have a little more independence themselves and their children. And so we provide these specially adapted homes, and they're very nice homes. They're all specifically designed for them. We have one that we're going to be dedicating on Veterans Day.
Tell me about Luis Avila, who you are going to be gifting one of these houses, one of the houses your foundation has created, on Veterans Day.
Luis, I met at Walter Reed.
Wow.
And Luis has a traumatic brain injury, a very serious traumatic brain injury. He's confined to a wheelchair. He's missing one leg. And when I first met Luis, he could barely lift his head up or make any sounds at all. To see him today and to see how far he's come is really miraculous. I mean, I've known them now for 4 or 5 years, whatever it is, and they've been living in a rented house. Yeah. His wife, Claudia, is this amazing tour de force who has fought for him every step of the way and raising their kids and fighting for Luis to get him the care he needs. And I offered to support them with the building of a specially designed home just for them through our RISE program. And almost every day, I'm getting choked up. Almost every day I will get a photograph, a text from Claudia, because she goes to the house every day
to check the progress.
Here's the floors are in, and now the thing is in, and now the doors are in, and now the windows are in, and look at this, and look at that. I mean, they're busting at the seams. And this is a family. Luis, he's made tremendous progress, but he's always going to need
special
care. You know, he's always going to need somebody to help him with something. So this special house will do something for this brave soldier who went out to defend our country, who...
Five tours of duty.
Yeah, I mean, you have to read his story. You can go to the Gary Sinise Foundation website, go to our RISE program page, and look up Luis Avila. He's given so much. His family has given so much that to be able to give them something back, give them a home that they can call their forever home, where she can have all this support inside to help her care for him, and where he can be a little bit more independent himself in there, and the kids will be able to grow up in there and come home.
What a gift.
And have room, not be all crowded and cramped. It's going to be just a real wonderful day to be able to see them get into their house.
Tell me about this initiative that's happening. When I walked into your offices here in California, there are women, a guy, but mostly women, spouses of our vets and our deceased vets, the people who paid the ultimate price. Every so often you bring them together here. Why?
Well, unfortunately, we have just thousands of military spouses who have lost a husband or a husband who's lost
a
wife. You know, certainly we've got children who've lost fathers and mothers. So we have a lot of grieving military families of our fallen. And I'm involved in, you know, a couple of different very important initiatives that address the needs specifically of our fallen heroes and the families that they've left behind, the survivors. One of those organizations is a great organization that's been around since 1994, called TAPS, Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. It was started by Bonnie Carroll when she lost her husband, and there was nowhere to turn, and so she started an organization just to help grieving family members of fallen heroes. I've had a great relationship with Bonnie and TAPS for many years. And I told Bonnie that I wanted to bring a group out and just give them a good time here in Hollywood. None of them had ever been here before. Mm-hmm. So getting out of their small towns around the country and coming to Hollywood and going to movie studios and meeting, you know, going to TV shows and doing different things, I thought would be just a great burst of joy for them, which they desperately need, going through this grieving that they're going through.
When we were last together, you talked to me about in the 90s, you and your wife are driving along in a car in North Carolina trying to outrun a hurricane, and she announces to you that she's converting to the Catholic faith. And that was kind of the genesis of your own journey to Catholicism. Has this been a faith journey for you, this foundation and the work that it requires and the people you've come in contact with?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, I could say, you know, 20 years ago when I did Forrest Gump, I would have never imagined that my life would have taken this turn. I mean, I'm glad I've had the great success in the movie business that I have, because it's given me resources to do something positive. It's all part of the service aspect of what our faith teaches us. You know, service above self is so much a part of our church. And that, you know, like I said, I could have never imagined that that's where I would be going. But I remember very specifically when my wife said, you know, her mom fell away from the church when she was younger, so she wasn't raised Catholic. But at one point, my wife turned to me and said, I'm going to become a Catholic. I'm going through the RCIA program. When we get home, I'm going to go to the local church and blah, blah, blah.
And she did.
She did all that. And so we had our kids go to Catholic school, which was a great thing for our family. We were going through some difficult times in those days, and the church was a great healer for in many ways. And it's been very important to our family, very important to me. And at a certain point, I just, you know, something happened, and I said, this is a calling. All this stuff that I've done prior to this,
with
movie
this
business, the television work, the theater company, the success I've had, this is what it's for. It's to give something. It's to be able to educate folks about the importance of service, the importance of supporting our veterans. These are our defenders, after all, and they need champions.
Final question. After all these years, meeting with these wounded warriors, being with their families, I've always said actors are probably the most perceptive people on the planet, because you're reading things beneath the surface and on the surface. What have you learned from these people that you serve and work with every day?
We have some extraordinary, extraordinary people that are serving our country. I mean, the men and women that I've met in the hospitals, outside the hospitals, on the battlefield, you know, at military bases, going through training. I mean, some extraordinary people. At all levels, you know, I've met the chairman and joint chiefs all the way down, you know, and everything in between.
Petty officers,
and we have some remarkable folks, you know, at our academies. When you go to our academies, and you see, the young people that have been accepted to those academies, that are serving there and learning, that are going to go on and be our future leaders, it gives you hope. It gives you comfort that we have a new generation of people that are going to be our future leaders. That's important. But also seeing what they go through, just trying to face the challenges that they faced, especially our wounded and our Gold Star families that are trying to get over these tremendous challenges that they face because of their service, is humbling, it's inspiring, and it's motivating. It motivates me every day to keep on this mission of trying to do something with what I've been given to support them.
You can find more about Gary Sinise and the work of his foundation at the GarySiniseFoundation.org. They do such incredible work. That is all the time we have for now. Until next week, a very happy Veterans Day to all of our veterans out there. We ask you to remember and pray for them and honor them for their sacrifice, which goes on throughout the year. That's all the time we have for now. Be sure to tune in next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.